God, they come through throughout the existence of WBAI being part of the Pacifica Radio Network for 62 years. The listeners have always come through. If you tell them what's up, if you tell them the straight and narrow info, no need to pretend. We're adults, okay? We're adults. We're grown people, all right? Grown people have to pay rent. Grown people have to pay bills. Grown people can accept good news as well as bad news. And it's all about how you adjust. And I'm telling you right now, giving this, sharing this information out there, it's not for me to fetishize bad news. It's not for me to get a thrill out of gloom and doom. I'm just sharing the information because it's needed to be shared. And you, the listening audience out there, you're owed to find out what is going on here at WBAI at this moment in time. So that's what I'm doing. 212-209-2950 is the number to call to show your support to this radio station. 212-209-2950. Again, WBAI's transmitter tower is behind, 2 months behind the rent. Here at 388 Atlantic Avenue is 3 months behind the rent. I give you the information. You choose to do whatever you want to do with that. 212-209-2950 or go to give to WBAI.org. Whatever you do and however you do it will be greatly appreciated. It's almost 2 minutes past 3 p.m. We're about to go into the return of the Katie Halper Show here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear the Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. On today's episode, I speak to journalist Derek Davison. Derek Davison began his journalistic career by covering the 2014 Ukraine crisis and the 2015 Iran nuclear deal talks. He started a blog that eventually evolved into the Substack newsletter Foreign Exchanges. He's the co-host of the American Prestige podcast. He has degrees in Middle East studies and Near Eastern languages and civilizations from the University of Chicago. Hello and welcome to the Katie Halper Show. So excited to be here with you. I'm pretty excited to bring in our guest. So welcome on to the virtual stage, Derek Davison.
Hey, Katie.
How are you?
Good. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Of course. Thanks so much for coming. So this is interesting. Did you think in 2014 when you were studying the Ukraine crisis that it would come to this in 2022?
I wish I could say I had that much foresight, but I probably would have been playing the stock market or something if I could predict that far in advance.
Yeah.
No, I thought things were going to stay even. I mean, I will cop to even like up to the point of the invasion. I was sort of incredulous that it would come to this. I really thought that things would stay perpetually the way they were with Russia sort of, you know, controlling, annexing Crimea. You know, it's not recognized, but they've done it. And sort of, you know, having the Donbass region and the separatists to play around with to keep Ukraine kind of in a state of instability. I figured they would be satisfied with that.
And what was it that caught your attention in the first place with the Ukraine crisis of 2014?
Well, I mean, part of it was I was, you know, just out of grad school and, you know, looking for something to write about that I could do as a freelancer, as a brand new freelancer. And that happened around that time. So it was just kind of my, you know, something I could cover. There's a lot of facets to the conflict. I mean, sort of, you know, you roll up the kind of, you know, the breakup of the Soviet Union and the ongoing aftermath of that, this, you know, very ancient history, you know, between the Ukrainian and Russian, you know, the various kind of Slavic peoples that I thought was interesting. I mean, none of that. You get into like very reductive thinking when you go down that road. But at the time, I thought that was kind of interesting, just the like kind of splintering apart of these people that had historically been linked quite a bit.
As someone who has studied this, what do you think the media misses or does not inform people about that's relevant to the conflict we're now seeing? Like, what's the historical background you think is missing from our conversations?
I mean, I think that in general, the 8 years of kind of back and forth along the front line shelling occasionally, you know, you had shooting across the front line in the Donbass, this like frozen conflict. I think the media, like for most of that time, just basically ignored it unless there was some kind of major, you know, artillery barrage in a given day and, you know, enough people got killed that it was worth kind of covering. But I feel like and some of this is hindsight, but it had the media covered that situation as less like, okay, they've, you know, reached a ceasefire, we can forget about that, and it had gone more, you know, day to day kind of covering what was going on in this place on both sides of the front line, you know, what the Ukrainian military was doing to people living in the separatist area, what the separatists were doing to people on the Ukrainian side of the front line. I feel like what happened early this year. Now, the invasion may have still been a surprise, but I feel like for many people, the fact that there is this there had been this kind of tense situation around this region came almost as a surprise. Like, oh, wait, that's still going on. Like, I feel like there were some balls dropped there along the way.
And where are we now? How would you describe the moment that we're in right now in terms of Russia, Ukraine? I was almost going to say like the whole world, which sounds kind of ridiculous, but in terms of the sanctions, you know, there was an article in Bloomberg that was called "Corporate Self-Sanctioning of Russia Has U.S. Fearing Economic Blowback." And the article read, "Russia's invasion of Ukraine galvanized the U.S., U.K., and European Union to unleash a slew of sanctions meant to punish Vladimir Putin's government and pressure him to pull his forces back. But some Biden administration officials are now privately expressing concern that rather than dissuading the Kremlin as intended, the penalties are instead exacerbating inflation, worsening food insecurity, and punishing ordinary Russians more than Putin or his allies." So what's happening there? And who could have seen that coming, by the way?
Yeah, I mean, only anybody who's paid attention to U.S. sanctions in Iran and North Korea and Venezuela. Could have foreseen this. I think when you get into questions of sanctions efficacy, you have to ask why they were imposed in the first place. And there's always like the public reason and then, you know, the reasons that nobody wants to talk about publicly. The sanctions were imposed in response to the invasion, and they were characterized as retaliation for the invasion, meaning essentially, you know, we want to hurt the Russian economy so much that Vladimir Putin has no choice but to turn around and pull his soldiers out. Nobody who's witnessed the way the United States has used sanctions and the effect that they've had around the world over the last even 20 years could have thought that it would work out that way, because that's not how sanctions, I mean, they're clearly sanctions have never been effective on that short a time frame in changing the behavior of the target country. Now, if you take a much longer term approach here and suggest that, you know, maybe these sanctions were imposed not for the immediate reason or the immediate cause of trying to get Russia to rethink its actions, but to isolate the Russian economy and cut it off and do what has been done to Iran, again, North Korea, Venezuela, these other places, Syria increasingly, to do the same thing to Russia, then, you know, it starts to make some sense. And that's really what the Bloomberg piece is talking about. I mean, it's collective punishment. It's collective kind of impose sanctions and then forget it. We just kind of go on our daily lives while the people in the target country suffer. But that's the point. The goal is, who knows, maybe just to leave these things in place in perpetuity. And maybe it's some kind of nebulous regime change, which, again, has never happened. I mean, nobody could look at U.S. sanctions and say that that's a realistic goal. So I feel like, you know, it's sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's disingenuous for the Biden administration, for people in the Biden administration to say, gosh, this isn't working the way we thought it was going to. Like, how did they think it was going to work? There's only the one model to go on, really.
And, you know, it's a kind of scary combination, I think, when having that, seeing how harmful the sanctions are, of course, not to the alleged targets of the sanctions, but that combined with the fact that it looks like the United States is very interested in prolonging this war. Reading another headline, this one is from the New York Times. The U.S. says it won't pressure Ukraine to negotiate an end to the war. The United States will not pressure Ukraine into negotiating a ceasefire, even as Russia grinds out steady gains on the ground in the country's embattled east, a top Pentagon official said on Tuesday. We're not going to tell the Ukrainians how to negotiate, what to negotiate, and when to negotiate, said Colonel H. Cal, the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy. They're going to set those terms for themselves. So all of a sudden, the United States is shifting gears and becoming a country that likes to empower other countries to take their to take their destiny into their own hands, and, you know, self-determination and sovereignty and all these things. What's your take on that statement, besides how funny it is?
I mean, Well, I laugh because, I mean, if the Ukrainians, I wonder if the Ukrainians, you know, announce tomorrow that they're, you know, an intense late stage negotiations on a ceasefire that would leave Russia, you know, more or less where it is now. I wonder if the U.S. would be so supportive of a deal like that. I suspect not. I suspect that this is, you know, we're not going to pressure the Ukrainians as long as their approach to negotiations kind of mirrors what the United States wants to get out of this war, which is a long term. I mean, people have said it, a long term weakening of Russia, the isolation of Russia, you know, maybe, you know, getting rid of Putin, which, again, is not a realistic goal, but is something people have hinted around about. You know, I suspect that if the Ukrainians suddenly got off that page, then you would not see this kind of we're fully supportive of whatever they want to do. That attitude would change quickly.
And of course, Boris Johnson went to visit Zelensky, right, and kind of discouraged him from brokering a peace deal with Putin.
Yeah, Boris has been there a couple of times, and I think he's delivered the same message both times, not to negotiate a peace deal. This last time was right after Macron and Olaf Scholz and Mario Draghi and I think the Klaus Johannes from Romania went. And it was sort of like, it was weird. Like, the dynamic of that trip was like Boris just showed up to say, hey, I'm here too. Like, you know, here I am.
Right.
I'm going to Ukraine too. It's become sort of this, like, really, I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a rite of passage almost for European leaders now to, like, pop off to Ukraine and show up in Kyiv and shake Volodymyr Zelensky's hand and like play that as a backdrop for their domestic political audience, which strikes me as somewhat gross, but that seems to be what it is now.
And what about the way the U.S. is arming Ukraine? Can you comment on that? How sustainable a model is that?
I mean, I think it's fairly sustainable. And they've allocated, I think, almost $50 billion in presidential drawdown authority, which is the money that Biden goes to when he makes these announcements that we're sending, you know, another $1 billion or another $500 million or whatever weapons to Ukraine. And he's got a ways to go to max that out. So he can continue this for a while. And of course, it's all good news to defense contractors who get to, you know, make new weapons either to send directly to Ukraine or to replace the ones that the U.S. sends to Ukraine. So, I mean, this is a model that benefits a lot of people who have fingers on important buttons in D.C. I don't think they'll run out of interest in continuing that.
I mean, it seems like people are increasingly making it clear that this is a proxy war. Some people are no longer even pretending that it's not a proxy war. Obviously, people who are critical of this war have been calling it a proxy war. You know, my co-host on Useful Idiots, Aaron Maté, has been saying that. He's kind of been ringing the bell sounding the alarms on that. But now you see people who are pro intervention who are saying that this is a proxy war. And I wanted us to watch one video clip. Brad, if we could play this one video clip. A friend of show, well, he doesn't know he's a friend of the show, and he's never been on the show, but I'd love to have him on the show. Max Boot, he's actually been on the show in that I've played clips of him. But Max Boot, who is a, how would you describe him? A neocon?
Yeah, a neocon, even, you know, he may even go beyond that a bit, but I describe him as, I think at some point his brain dissolved and that hat that he has on it, his drawing there, replaced it.
Yeah, that's a charitable way of describing whatever his condition is. So he had something interesting to say on Morning Joe. And again, this is a guy who, there's a great clip that I've played in the past of Max Boot and Steve Cohen, the late Russian scholar. The late scholar of Russian history, Steve Cohen, where Max Boot just fully tries to just McCarthyite him, neo-McCarthyite him, old-school McCarthyite him. And Stephen Cohen just is in so elegantly and eloquently kind of shames him for doing what he's doing. Have you seen that clip, by the way?
I haven't, no.
Okay, this, maybe I'll look for it later because it's really
I'm allergic to Morning Joe, I think.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. I'm speaking to journalist Derek Davison. Oh, yeah. No, this is the one I'm talking about now. Sorry, that was from Anderson Cooper.
Oh, okay. All right.
But this is a great clip that we have from Morning Joe, which Brad's going to play for us.
Absolutely essential. And I think the key here is we have to understand that we're making a mistake in the way that we think about the war, because we keep thinking about it as their war. The Ukrainians are fighting. We need to think about it as our war. Putin is waging war on the West. He is trying to destroy the rules-based international order that we Americans, we Europeans, we all stand for. This. This is a direct threat to all of us, and we need to understand this is not a foreign aid project. This is not charity. This is self-defense. This is the front line of freedom right here in the Donbass. The Ukrainians are fighting and dying for all of us. We need to step up. And to echo what Ed Luce was saying, it is unacceptable that right now the Ukrainians are being outgunned 10 to 1 in artillery, 10 to 1. They are losing over 100 soldiers a day. The United States has not seen those kinds of losses since World War II. The Ukrainians are willing to fight. They are willing to die. They are defending their land. They are standing up to one of the most evil dictators in the world. But they don't have the weapons they need to get the job done. They have just enough to prevent a Russian victory, but they don't have enough to defeat the Russians, to win for Ukraine. And that is unacceptable. All of us need to step up. The Europeans in particular, as Joe suggested, because they are doing less than we are. But we need to step up, too. We're not providing Gray Eagle drones that the Ukrainians need. We're not providing as many multiple launch rocket systems as they need. All of us collectively can be and should be doing more, because we need to understand this is our fight that the Ukrainians are on the front lines of.
So
hard to know where to begin there.
Yeah, up to you. I'll follow your lead.
I mean, you know, everything there's pretty much wrong on one level or another. This is not a war against the West. Ukraine is not in NATO. There is no vital U.S. interest in Ukraine or in protecting Ukraine. This is our involvement is a choice. It's a conscious choice. I think Max is missing Afghanistan, which he characterized, you know, around the time of the U.S. withdrawal as the permanent frontier war. It should be treated as such, you know, from like the 19th century frontier wars, and the United States should stay there indefinitely. Now he's found a new cause, lucky for him, I guess, to replace that conflict. But the argument here that there's some vital interest in defending the rules-based order. I mean, if the United States wants to defend the rules-based order, it should start by actually abiding by the rules. Like we never abide by the rules. We didn't in Iraq. We didn't in Afghanistan. We didn't, you know, we don't when we, you know, impose these massive, you know, humanitarian risking, life threatening sanctions on countries just because they don't sort of toe the line. It's ridiculous to talk about the rules based order. It's ridiculous to talk about any rules based order that the U.S. is supposedly the architect of. And this is a big part of the reason why, by the way, you talk about, you know, the Biden administration having to do, you know, extra diplomacy to try to get countries in the Middle East and in Africa, even sort of, you know, Latin America and parts of Asia on board with this, you know, whole program of sanctioning Russia. Part of the reason for that is that the people in these countries see the hypocrisy of talking about defending a rules-based order where the United States gets to break all the rules, but everybody else has to sort of abide by them. The last thing I'll say, and I sort of, you know, like losing my train of thought because I can't remember everything that he said there. But this talk of like sending more advanced weapon systems, this is really, we're on a slippery slope. We're already on that slippery slope. We started sending the multiple launch rocket systems. We've only sent a few so far, but the demand, the calls to send more are only going to grow. And I suspect that, you know, the United States, the Biden administration, the military industrial complex will all be on board with that. But you start to get into things like advanced drones, and more kind of more sophisticated hardware. These are things that may not be able to survive the environment that we would be sending them into. There was just a piece, I think, I don't know if it was in the Times, it was somewhere today, I sort of brushed past it, that, you know, Ukrainians, even Ukrainian military officials aren't sure that they want Gray Eagle drones because they're so close to, they're fighting so close to the Russian border and so close to Russian air defense systems. It's not clear they would even be that effective. But you're going to, you know, you just keep calling for more and more and more and more. And that's how you, you know, that's how you wind up creating a bigger quagmire and meshing the United States even deeper into this conflict.
Yeah, and I mean, his argument, I was waiting for him to compare Putin to Hitler because that's a favorite argument of certain people. Like we saw Michael McFaul make that argument. I mean, people have even argued that it was almost like comedic. A couple of people in one weekend were saying how at least Hitler didn't XYZ. They were actually positioning Putin as worse than Hitler.
Right.
Putin didn't do that in this particular instance. But this idea that, you know, this over-vilification of Putin as on a kind of civilization-based mission, eliminationist, or people are throwing around the word genocide. Do you think that they believe this stuff, or are they just saying this because they want to scare people into supporting the U.S. proxy war?
I mean, I think that some of the language that gets used, genocide in particular, is misguided. It's meant to shock people. It's, you know, sort of meant to get to kind of dig at people's emotions and feelings. I mean, Putin, for all I know, may think of himself as on some kind of a great civilizational quest. I don't, you know, there's been a lot of like armchair psychoanalyzing going on with respect to Putin and even like medical diagnosis. You know, there've been these videos of him, you know, looking puffy or whatever, and that, you know, sends us into a 2-day thing about what is he dying of. And you know, I mean, that's all kind of nonsense on some level. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's possible that, you know, he's an older guy. I don't know if he's unwell or not. It doesn't, you know, but either way, he's sort of, you know, got fewer years ahead of him than behind him. Maybe he's thinking in terms of, like, I don't want to be the guy who lost Ukraine or something like that. That could be possible. But I think to throw around overheated terms like, you know, this is some kind of civilizational struggle for survival or genocide, is really meant more to play at people's sympathies than an actual attempt to analyze what's going on.
What is the cost on other countries? Like, what is the fallout going to be of these sanctions on other countries? What's going to happen to everywhere from like Europe to Africa?
Right. So, I mean, we're already seeing some of the fallout of the war, which is sort of the invasion plus the sanctions and the effect that they've had, that's had on food exports. You know, the Russians have stopped exporting much of their food, although they've made some exceptions, I think, for Central Asia. Ukraine has been unable to export food. And these are, I mean, these are two breadbasket countries. They export a lot of grain. They export a lot of cooking oil. And so you're seeing, you know, countries that are food importers, that tend to be food importers, like Egypt, Sudan, you know, Lebanon. This has been a big, big concern in Lebanon, and elsewhere in Africa and parts of the Middle East, Yemen, for example. You know, this is really impacting humanitarian efforts there. The shortages of, and the, you know, the consequent rise in price of basic commodities is a huge blow for these places. In terms of Europe, I mean, I think the big impact is in terms of energy. And that'll come primarily in the form of natural gas. Now, Europe, the EU has already imposed an embargo on most of the Russian oil that it was importing. They'll have to figure out how to, you know, find new sources or alternative energy, you know, to replace that oil. But Europe is far more dependent on Russia for natural gas. And we've seen just over the last week or two, the Russians cutting gas shipments to Europe substantially. I mean, cutting off entire countries, cutting, you know, shipments to Germany by half or more. And that's really going to hurt Europe as winter approaches, and there have been moves to, you know, try to impose conservation measures to find alternative suppliers. You know, the alternative energy, the kind of green alternative energy option, is always seems to be last on the list because it's the most complicated and would require the most infrastructure.
God forbid we save the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, God forbid you take this opportunity to do something good for the planet.
Right.
Absolutely. So that's going to be a big blow to Europe. And we haven't even seen, I think, the worst of that, which will come if these gas supplies aren't somehow, you know, replaced by wintertime and people are trying to heat their homes and being told, you know, sorry, we don't have enough gas for that.
Shifting gears a little bit. It's funny. Someone in the chat actually said Ukraine asked for American help. I guess they aren't legitimate, though. So that person's being sarcastic. But how do we kind of grapple with that? Yes, there are people in countries who are asking for help. What do you think the criteria should be for whether or not the United States? I mean, I was going to say helps, but I would put helps in quotes because I, from my point of view, I don't actually think that it's ultimately helping Ukraine.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I try to look at this on a broader scope, and in terms of, like, you're always going to have cases where you can make the argument that the empire serves a good purpose. Like, we're serving a good purpose. This is a worthy cause. These are, you know, worthy people defending their country from, and we should help them. But if you look at the systems that you're fueling by doing that, and this is, you know, the way the assistance, U.S. assistance has gone here is particularly acute, I think, because it's mostly in the form of buying weapons and sending weapons, and that results in, you know, funneling billions of dollars to defense contractors who then turn around and lobby in D.C. for a $800 billion a year military budget, $900 billion a year military budget. We're going to be at $1 trillion in a couple of years. And you just perpetuate this system that views every problem as a military problem that has only one solution, which is always a military solution, whether it's directly or, you know, through things like training and weapons. And I just, you know, I feel like at some point that has to be, you have to just pull the plug on it. And even if that means, you know, this particular cause or that particular cause, gosh, you know, couldn't we make an exception here or there? I that just keeps the system going to me. And it's, you know, I think the bigger picture is important here.
I mean, especially because it seems clear that the real motives for the United States, I mean, spoiler alert, are not humanitarian ones, are not about saving the lives of Ukrainians, because if it were, they would be much more involved in negotiations and forcing and diplomacy. So I think that I don't really believe, I guess I'm agreeing with you, and I don't believe that the United States can kind of just accidentally, while doing things in the interest of empire, help people. I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, it's almost never the case. I mean, I don't want to say never because I'll think of some counterexample, you know, an hour from now, but almost never the case that you get to a good place through, you know, using the empire in this way. I would say on the, you know, the question of peace talks, you know, at this point, you know, I agree with letting the Ukrainians take the lead and negotiating their own settlement. What I wonder is, as I said earlier, when the Ukrainians are prepared to do that, is the United States still going to let them take the lead? Are we going to be willing to peel off these sanctions if that's the price of, you know, supporting Ukraine in negotiating a peace deal? And I question that. And it's obviously speculation. We don't know until it actually happens. But I question whether there's going to be a willingness to really put the sanctions on the table and say, look, you know, if this is what it takes for you to negotiate the peace deal that you want, then we will abide by that. I doubt it, but, you know, we'll see.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI, that's 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. I'm speaking to journalist Derek Davison. So wanted to ask you about some other parts of the world. We just had historic elections in Colombia where a leftist won for the first time. We also had an election in France. And then we're having something interesting happening in Israel. So you can start with everyone you want to start talking about.
I mean, we could start in Colombia with the election of Gustavo Petro, which was somewhat surprising to me. I mean, he won the first round in late May. But the runner up, somewhat surprisingly, was another political outsider of the far right, of, you know, far right persuasion, Rodolfo Hernandez, who was a TikTok star and businessman and very Trumpian kind of guy in many ways.
And he said, to be fair, he did say he admired Adolf Hitler. But,
you know, I mean, who among us?
Well, the thing is, I think he actually, I kind of believe him. Either way, it's not good because he claimed that he confused Einstein with Hitler, which is funny because imagine how upset Hitler would be to be confused with him. So either he is a Hitler fan, Hitler supporter, or he's like daft enough to confuse those two people.
Yeah, neither one of those is good,
yeah,
I guess.
Neither one of those bodes well, yeah.
But I thought that was bad news for Petro. I have to be honest.
Yeah, I heard you on American Prestige on your podcast. I heard you predict that he was going to lose.
I felt like the polling had indicated that Hernandez was maybe slightly ahead. Hernandez also had the outsider thing, the kind of outsider cred that Petro had, in the sense that, you know, I think a lot of this election was driven by disgust with the political establishment, and that's why these two candidates were the ones that who made it to the runoff. And in a country that's got as much history of right-wing politics or sort of right-wing dominated politics as Colombia, I thought it all kind of aligned to be a bad matchup for Petro. But you know, obviously he was able to eke it out, you know, he certainly has plans to, you know, try to tackle inequality, corruption, take a different approach to crime, and all very promising things. I think he's going to struggle in a couple of ways. He's going to struggle in the ways that leftists in Latin America always struggle, because the big brother to the north doesn't like having leftists elected in Latin America, and certainly in a country like Colombia, where it's always been reliably center right to right wing politics, which is what Washington wants. You know, he's gonna struggle in that regard to some degree. He's also probably gonna struggle because the congressional election, which took place at the same time as the first round, produced the first round of the presidential election, produced a fairly fragmented Congress. So I mean, legislatively, he's likely to have to push pretty hard to get things passed. So you know, I'm pleasantly surprised by the outcome. I think he's got his work cut out for him, but we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens. Okay, so we can move.
Yeah, I'm moving.
We can move on. Yeah. Yeah.
So that's Colombia. Yeah.
Well, the other election. I mean, the other election this weekend was the French parliamentary election, which turned out kind of in line with polling. Emmanuel Macron's centrist, center right, really coalition lost its parliament, its majority in the National Assembly, lost like 101 or 102 seats, I think. He's kind of stuck now for his, you know, having just been reelected to a second term. It's going to be a very interesting dynamic in terms of what he does legislatively. Having lost the majority, there's a leftist coalition that was organized by Jean-Luc Mélenchon, who was one of the contenders running in the presidential election this year. Mélenchon had been pushing hard to win, to come out with a majority and become prime minister, but they fell short of that. But if the coalition holds together, and you know, it may not, but we'll see. That'll be the largest opposition bloc in the assembly, so they could do a lot with that. They could really frame the politics of the next 5 years with that, from that position. The other surprise was that the far right did quite well. The National Rally Party of Marine Le Pen exceeded expectations. They went from, like, I think 8 seats in the assembly to 89 or 90. So I mean, clearly, again, you talk about dissatisfaction with the establishment, with the centrist establishment. That's what happened here as well. It wasn't enough to cost Macron the presidential election, but clearly it's kind of out there for everybody to see in the results of the parliamentary election. Like I said, it's going to be, I don't know what Macron's going to do. The obvious move for him would have been to reach out to the Republicans, the conservative, kind of mainstream conservative party, and try to form a coalition. But they've said, no, we're not interested in doing that. So I think he just had all the opposition parties, or all the, you know, all the various parties, you know, hosted their leaders for a discussion of, you know, where do we go from here today? I don't know what came of that. But, you know, he's clearly in a situation where he's going to struggle, I think, to get, you know, I say reforms. They're all things like raising the retirement age and, like, you know, shoving people back down in the salt mine. So
yeah,
it's probably good that he will struggle, but that's where things
seriously
stand.
Yeah. And what about Israel?
Israel's going to heading to its fifth election in a bit over 3 years. The coalition that emerged after the previous election, 2020, and held together, I think, longer than expected, or 2021, I guess. Let me double check that. So it was early 2021. Sorry, I thought it was late 2020, but early 2021. I mean, there had been this, there had been four elections basically in 2 years. In Israel, all of them hinging on the fact that nobody could form a majority, like Benjamin Netanyahu, who had been prime minister for many years up to that point, kept falling just short of a majority with his party, Likud, and their coalition partners. And so finally, in this most recent election, which was in March 2021, a coalition of like really disparate parties, I mean, from the far right to the left, including an Arab party for the first time in Israel's history, having an Arab party in government. They formed a coalition that was basically meant to keep Netanyahu from becoming prime minister again. And that was really the only thing that held these parties together. They managed to survive this long, which I think is longer than you might have expected when the coalition was first formed. The idea has been to sort of wait out Netanyahu's corruption trial and see if, you know, that would remove him from politics altogether, and then you could sort of go, you know, go to a new election and get back to normal. But that the corruption trial's kind of stalled out. What happened earlier this month was the coalition was unable to pass a fairly straightforward bill that all Israeli governments have to pass to continue the special legal status of West Bank settlements. So the West Bank settlements are governed under Israeli law, unlike the rest of the West Bank, which is governed under military law. And that status has to be renewed periodically. And it's sort of a pro forma thing, but they were unable to do it. And then, you know, people started quitting the coalition. They were down to 59 votes, I think, in a 120 seat legislature. So they didn't have a majority anymore. And they finally decided to pull the plug a couple of days ago and dissolve the coalition. They're going to go to elections in October, I think. And it'll once again be about Netanyahu and whether he can bring back his majority and return to the prime ministership.
What do you think the future of the occupation is?
I mean, the occupation can go on indefinitely at this point. There's nothing, there's no countervailing weight anymore. It's not, I mean, it's never come from the United States. There was always this little kind of pull from the perspective of Israel's desire to normalize relations with the Arab states around it. But the Abraham Accords, which the Trump administration negotiated, and then, you know, the Biden administration has been making every effort to expand those accords, which covered, I think, the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan. The Biden administration would love to add Saudi Arabia to that list. They're sort of, you know, bending over backwards to try and get it, something done in that regard. So even that tiny little bit of you know, kind of counterweight on the Palestinian side is gone. There's nothing. I mean, there's really nothing that the Israelis need or want that would be furthered by easing the occupation. So I think, you know, it's going to take something unforeseen to shake that status quo up. I should say, you know, I guess I sort of downplayed it earlier. This is an apartheid system. The settlements exist in an apartheid system. They exist under one preferential legal code. The rest of the West Bank exists under a far less generous one. That's the definition of apartheid. And that's what the Israelis were unable to extend. I think they will now with the coalition dissolved. There's no reason for Netanyahu and the opposition not to support an extension of that system. But, you know, that can go on in perpetuity at this point, I think, without some external pressure. And I don't know where that's going to come from or where that could come from.
There's a lot of talk about the multipolar world. Can you just share what that is and how you see that framing?
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's the rise of China as a quote unquote peer competitor to the United States. The Chinese economy, the Chinese military, increasingly they have, you know, they just launched another aircraft carrier. They have three now to our 11. I mean, it's sort of, you know, you have to project, you have to do a lot of projection. Like U.S. military planners will talk about the Chinese nuclear arsenal. That's still a fraction of what the United States has. There was just a couple of weeks ago, a big harangue about the Ream naval base in Cambodia, which is being rebuilt in a Chinese finance project. And U.S., you know, the U.S. military is afraid that that base is going to be used by the Chinese Navy, which would give China all of two overseas naval bases as compared to 750 or 800, depending on how you count. And what you count as a base for the U.S. military. So it's all a lot of like projection about what might be and trying to find something to be afraid of. But it is a return to a world where the United States is not the only superpower, which is what we really saw in the 90s, the unipolar, so-called unipolar moment that was kind of frittered away in part, I think, by the war on terror. But also, you know, you have to incorporate China's economic rise and its military rise in that. Russia gets talked about sometimes as part of this multipolar world. I know Russian officials like to talk about Russia as part of this multipolar superpower competition or, you know, relationship. You know, economically, I don't think they fit the bill anymore. Militarily, certainly with the number of nuclear warheads that Russia has, probably they have to be considered in that conversation. But that's basically, I mean, it's a return to a world where there's more than one quote unquote superpower.
You're listening to The Katie Halper Show. I'm your host, Katie Halper. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI, that's 99.5 FM, or WBAI.org. I'm speaking to journalist Derek Davison.
Not to sound like Jem Psaki, but circling back to the question of sanctions and backfiring, how are these sanctions backfiring? Many people say that they're actually strengthening Putin and weakening the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that Bloomberg piece was I think, illustrative. And a lot of it is knock-on effects of the sanctions. What they talked about in that Bloomberg piece was not just the direct effect of U.S. sanctions, but it's the follow-on effects, which are, again, are the things that you see in other places that are targeted by the U.S. With these types of maximalist secondary sanctions, where companies, private, you know, companies, even if they're not in danger of technically running afoul of sanctions, will sort of self-quit a country. They'll leave of their own accord because they're afraid of running afoul of sanctions. It's not worth it to them to continue to do business in these places if there's any risk of being blacklisted by the United States. So they leave, and that creates a host of hardships for in places where these foreign countries, in some cases, or foreign companies, in some cases U.S. companies, are a big part of the economy in these places. It creates extra hardship, and that winds up. I hate to keep pointing to the same set of examples, but none of the other countries that have experienced this have gone through the regime change that it seems like the United States so desperately wants. Instead, they do create some tension on a long enough timeline. I mean, there are protests in Iran right now about the state of the Iranian economy, but more often than not, they create a rally around the flag effort. They make the United States and whatever message we're trying to deliver, again, about the rules based order or the great wonderful benefits of capitalism and democracy. It discredits those things because people understand that it's the United States that's inflicting this pain on them. So yeah, it's not even useful from the only standpoint from which sanctions seem to work is if you just want to immiserate the populations of these countries and leave them kind of wallowing and cut off from the global economy. If that's the goal, to just do that and have that be the new reality or the new status quo, then I guess they work. But if you have any goal beyond that, they don't seem to achieve anything like anything else.
We talk about empire and how the United States is guided by that over humanitarian concerns. What exactly does the United States want? Like Lloyd Austin talked about how he wanted to, I don't remember, degrade Putin. I can't remember the actual verb, but basically that this is about degrading Russia. So what exactly is their goal? Like what does that mean? What are the benefits that the United States would reap if they were able to degrade Russia thusly?
Yeah, it's not clear because it's not I don't view Russia as having been a threat. I mean, the one way that Russia is a threat, I guess, to the United States is, again, in the number of nuclear warheads they have. But you're not going to degrade, hopefully, you're not going to degrade their nuclear arsenal in this conflict, which would, mean that they're using it. Economically, Russia was not, other than oil and gas, which admittedly are huge things, but in overall economic sense, Russia was not a competitor on the same level of the U.S. or China or even the EU. Militarily, I don't know where this competition was happening at this point, but that does seem to be what they want to get out of this. They want to wreck the Russian economy. They want Russia to spill out its conventional military force in Ukraine and be so badly decimated that they can't do it anywhere else. And as to the reasons for that, I mean, strictly a question of who's the big, being the big dog on the block. I mean, it's the United States wanting to be, wanting to maintain its status as the sole military superpower, which, it has lost its status, I think, as the great economic superpower, even if it does have a, considerable economic edge over the rest of the world in terms of the dollar, in terms of, just the size of the U.S. economy. I think it's there's a military component to this when they talk about eroding Russia that I think is you know, they've been an irritant in places like Syria and Libya. So maybe that's enough. Maybe that's what it means, just to kind of remove Russia from the scene in places that the U.S. wants to dominate.
Is there a doctrine or like a coherent worldview or ideology that you think can be attributed to the United States or to Biden or the Biden administration?
You know, I think there's, Bessner talks about this on the show a lot. There's like an imperial retrenchment. There's an effort to hold on to what we have. And, you know, Afghanistan kind of fell out, but even, you know, with the military pullout, the United States is still inflicting economic pain on Afghanistan on a level that's, you know, akin to some of these other places, to try and control that country or try to control that region. So, I mean, yeah, I think it's an assessment that the United States can't be everywhere all at once on some, you know, on some level, kind of the lizard brain portion of the DC mindset, but that we want to be able to pretend that we can be in every place all at once. And that's why we make these commitments. You know, Biden's probably going to make a new security commitment to the Saudis and the UAE when he goes to the Middle East next month. That's why we make commitments to Taiwan. We make commitments to Ukraine. We make commitments in all these different parts of the world that, you know, if push comes to shove, can you actually envision the United States fulfilling those commitments? And it's doubtful. But you know, we make them because that's sort of a demonstration of our imperial reach, I guess.
Yeah. Did you see someone said that Biden was going to meet with Mohammed bin Salman, but not like one-on-one directly? It was that they were going to both be at the same meeting. And so they'd probably have a chance to talk.
I think this was a lame attempt at spinning what is, you know, kind of a bad PR look for the Biden administration. He's going next month to Israel and then, you know, have a brief stop in the West Bank. And then he's going to go to Saudi Arabia for a conference, the Gulf Cooperation Council member states, those six countries, plus I think Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq. Yes, Egypt, Jordan, and Iraq. So it's the GCC plus three. The assumption has been, and I think the Saudis have even said, that there will be an official meeting between Mohammed bin Salman and Biden while he's there, while he's in Jeddah. The administration it did this weird thing where they're like, well, they're not going to meet directly, but they'll both be at the same meeting. And if they should happen to encounter one another, it's like, I mean, it's a very lame kind of spin to try and downplay the fact that Biden is going to go hat in hand, really, to this guy who is responsible for so much destruction in Yemen, who's responsible for the Jamal Khashoggi murder and doesn't have a good reputation still in the West, to kind of downplay that so they don't take a big political hit for it. It's kind of lame on by the standards of DC spin. I found it
right
kind of lame,
which is saying a lot.
Yeah.
I actually have that clip. If we can watch it. This is with Jennifer Granholm, who's the Secretary of Energy. She's on State of the Union with Dana Bash.
We'll visit Saudi Arabia next month to talk about this. On Friday, he said, quote, I'm not going to meet with Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. I'm going to an international meeting and he's going to be part of it. Can you clarify this? Is he going to meet with the Saudi Crown Prince to talk about oil prices or not?
Well, he's going for the purpose of this international conference.
But
I know that I think he will meet with the Saudi Crown Prince. He has asked for all suppliers around the globe to increase production. That includes OPEC, that includes our domestic oil and gas producers. He's asking for an increase like other leaders around the globe are increasing.
So they will have a one-on-one meeting.
That's my understanding that he will be meeting, but there's a series of meetings around energy overall. The Saudis are very interested, for example, in developing an expertise around hydrogen, clean hydrogen production. So I think there's a series of topics related to energy on the table.
Can you explain why, to the American people, why it is appropriate for a U.S. president to meet with a dictator who murdered and chopped up a journalist to do that when it comes to human rights, given what he has said before about it.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the president is a strong believer in human rights and has condemned Saudi
Arabia.
Just to
be clear, he didn't actually do the murder, he ordered it.
Of course, but I totally understand that. And the president is very concerned about that, and I'm sure we'll raise that issue. But he's also very concerned about what people are experiencing at the pump. And Saudi Arabia is head of OPEC. And we need to have increased production so that everyday citizens in America will not be feeling this pain that they're feeling right now. So all around the world, he is asking for people to increase production, but especially our own oil and gas producers. And to their credit, in some ways, they are, some of them have decided that they are going to increase production, but it's still not enough. And that's why we're asking for this additional meeting this week.
So there you have it. They're going to hang out at the same table.
They're going to pass a note around the table.
Yeah.
Back and forth. I mean, there's two things that the Biden administration could do right now to increase the supply of oil on the market. They could drop sanctions on Iran and drop sanctions on Venezuela. They won't do that. They're going to instead go through this performative thing of asking countries in, you know, many countries that are already struggling to meet, you know, their quota, their sort of OPEC plus defined quotas. They're going to ask the Saudis, who will probably say no anyway, to produce more, to drill for more oil, produce more oil, instead of taking these two very easy steps of taking Iran and Venezuela off the blacklist, which would, you know, have vastly more impact than anything he's going to get out of this meeting or the efforts that they've been undertaking to try and bring gas prices down.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Derek. Any final words, points you want to make, shout outs, plugs?
Yeah, I mean, check out the show. We're at AmericanPrestigePod.com. My newsletter is fx.substack.com. Both of those projects are on Substack. Yeah, definitely people should check them out. And, you know, we'd love to have you guys.
Well, thank you so much again. And everyone listen to their podcast. It's really great.
We're looking for a third mic. I thought Rodrigo Duterte, the president of the Philippines, he's going to be out of a job soon. So I thought maybe he could join us, but we'll see how it goes.
Let me know if you need any more suggestions. Duterte turns you down. Let me know.
Thank you, Katie. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Thank you so much.
Thanks,
see you
Katie.
Soon and come back.
Definitely.
Bye. Journalist Derek Davison. Thank you so much for listening to The Katie Halper Show. You can hear The Katie Halper Show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. on WBAI. That's 99.5 FM or WBAI.org. See you next week.
And the previous program was The Katie Halper Show. And that program is on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. And Katie had a very interesting conversation with journalist Derek Davison. And kudos on that program, Katie, as well as welcome back to the airways of WBAI. And if you appreciate what this station brings to the table on a regular basis, well, this is my time to appeal to the listening audience to let you know where, what you can do to show your financial support to this radio station. And that number is 212-209-2950. Or go to give to WBAI.org online. By now, you should know throughout the month of June, we're making attempts to raise funds for not only for the rent to the transmitter at 4 Times Square, but also for the rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue. The transmitter is behind 2 months. The rent here is at 388 Atlantic Avenue is 3 months behind. The rent for the transmitter is $17,000 a month. The rent here at 388 Atlantic Avenue is $10,000 a month. You can do the math. And we need your help. Otherwise, you would not hear me at this point in time. So, 212-209-2950 or go to gift2wbai.org online. As I've said before, management has required me to pitch in between shows in order to appeal to the listening audience like yourselves. And as I've said before, things have to be pretty desperate when management is asking me to pitch. Okay? So, hint, hint, it's desperate. All right? As I said to you before, I'm not here to try to coddle, sugarcoat any what's happening going on.